Friday, October 2nd, 1992. In the Fall series, Jung's Infancy and Childhood and Its Influence on the Development of Analytical Psychology, Dr. Brian Feldman speaks. At the age of 83, Dr. Jung made the following observation. I have never fully unwound the tangle of my earliest memories. They are like individual shoots of a single underground rhizome, like stations on a road of unconscious development. This lecture will explore Jung's infancy and childhood and its influences upon the development of the theory of analytical psychology.
Thank you very much, Lucretia, for introducing me in such a nice way. And thank you, Jung Society in Seattle, for inviting me here. It's the first time that I've been to Seattle, and it's been a lovely experience for me, being in your beautiful city, seeing green, which for me is so unusual. Coming from California, I was praying and wishing that there would be rain. So for me, this is a welcome experience. I'm going to talk tonight about a topic which has been of great interest to me during the last years for a number of reasons, a number of personal reasons. First of all, I've been very interested over the years in working with children and working with the inner child in adult clients. And I'd always been very drawn from the very beginning of my psychological work to Jungian theory, but I was always quite perplexed about why Jung hadn't specifically evolved a theory of child development. He had some interesting publications on children, especially one called Psychic Conflicts in a Child, which actually, it turns out, is about his own daughter. This came out in one of his letters to Freud. And it's a very sensitive response, in a way, to Freud's book on Little Hans. It was written about the same time. It was, in a sense, a present to Freud. But it's interesting that after his break with Freud in 1914, he really rarely delved into the topic of developmental psychology. He had an article, I believe, called The Child Archetype, but really didn't deal specifically with, in a sense, real children and the developmental aspects of his adult clients. I did come across an interesting quote today about some of his reflections on this. This is not in my paper, but it came up later, where he said that the therapy, really, I believe he was working at the Berghotsli, and he said therapy only began after the discussion of one's childhood. Feeling in some way that therapy didn't begin before that or during that period. I thought that was very interesting. In some way, he tended to put aside childhood. And even in his work in Zurich, when I've spoken to people who trained there with Jung, he would often, if a client came with personal conflicts that were of great import to them, he would often send them to his associate, Tony Wolf, and he would wait until the archetypal themes came up in their dreams and in the clinical material before he would also begin to take on the case, and they would work concurrently. So there was this intriguing, I felt, separation of the personal and the archetypal. And in my own work, in my own analysis, I always felt that the two were inextricably linked together, that it was always very difficult to separate out exactly what is archetypal in one's early childhood experience and what is deeply, deeply personal. So this curiosity over the years led me to wonder, well, perhaps there was something in Jung's own childhood and infancy that led to his particular development in this direction. You know, Jung always stated that the subjectivity of the analyst had a great deal to do with the theories that they developed. So I thought it might be important to apply this lesson to Jung himself and to try to understand and analyze what to me was a real perplexing situation. So let me start now with that introduction. At the age of 83, Jung made the following observation. I have never fully unwound the tangle of my earliest memories. They are like individual shoots of a single underground rhizome, like stations on a road of unconscious development. Little has been written concerning Jung's childhood and infancy, and its relationship to the development of his work. Although some work was done by a close associate of Jung's, Marie-Louise von Franz. Von Franz takes an archetypal approach to Jung's childhood and tends to avoid a personal exploration of Jung's early life. She relates that from early childhood, Jung's own dreams contain the most impressive mythological images which could not possibly have been explained through his own personal memories, and for which Jung found explanatory parallels in religious history only many years later. When the origins of the Jungian approach are investigated, invariably, Jung's relationship with Freud, their meeting, their collaboration, and their eventually painful break becomes the point of focus. Analytical psychology is often seen as an outgrowth of Freud's creative energies, which gave shape to psychoanalysis. To date, Jung's infancy and childhood have not been dealt with from a developmental perspective. Approaching the origins of analytical psychology from this vantage point, I would like to offer the hypothesis that the experiences of Jung's infancy and childhood had a profound influence upon his later thought and the development of his theories, which took place throughout his long and creative life. I was personally drawn to this material for several reasons. First, I have found Jung's autobiographical study, Memories, Dreams, Reflections, a seminal work. While not officially included in Jung's collected works, it is indispensable for understanding the development of his thought, as it provides some of the personal background out of which his ideas evolved. It is the work of a creative genius who struggled to give shape to chaotic and psychologically overwhelming experiences. It was this book which sparked my own interest in Jungian psychology many years ago. In it, I found a psychological depth which I felt was lacking in other depth psychologies. As I matured as a clinical psychologist and later as an analyst, and as I began to analyze children and the childhood of my adult patients, I began to wonder about the lack of a coherent theory of child development in Jungian psychology. I found this a conspicuous lack in the Jungian field. I was perplexed why Jung did not reflect more on this important area. Granted, one man can only explore so much in a lifetime, but as my experience as an analyst expanded, it became clearer that a coherent theory of infantile and childhood development is essential for treating patients analytically. While developments in the post-Jungian field have evolved in a developmental direction with contributions by such analysts as Fordham and others, Jung left this field largely untouched. I was reminded that in one of Jung's major works, Two Essays on Analytical Psychology, Jung talks about the temperamental and typological differences between himself, Freud, and Adler, and he states that these personality differences form the basis for their differing theoretical approaches. I thought that it would be helpful to expand on this observation and attempt to understand Jung's own personality structure and its development in infancy and early childhood to begin to understand more about the development of his ideas. In this way, links could be made between Jung's adult development, when his major psychological theories evolved, and his infancy and early childhood, when the foundations of his personality were laid down. Utilizing the vividly described memories, dreams, and fantasies that Jung has described in Memories, Dreams, Reflections, I set out on a journey whose goal was to understand Jung's intellectual development. I found this task akin to playing with blocks and making constructions with them. Jung describes his experiences and attaches a particular meaning to them. It is important to understand that he is reflecting back upon his childhood from age 83, and I think that the meaning he attaches to his memories is filtered through a lifetime filled with creative experiences. the feeling of the infant and child is not emphasized. Therefore, I would like to try to get inside this material in an empathic and imaginative way and try to understand what it was like for him as an infant and child. I am trying to play with the material and understand it from the vantage point of my own background in clinical psychology and child analysis. Jung states in his autobiography that he did not discuss his early childhood with anyone until he was 65 years old. He held on to these memories because they provided him with a secret truth and enabled him to preserve a sense of the privacy and integrity of his developing self. In another vein, the early experiences were so painful and often so emotionally overwhelming and confusing that he felt unsure whether another individual would be able to understand and acknowledge them. Jung maintained throughout his life a need for privacy and solitude, which enabled him to plunge into the depths of his own mind for his creative sustenance. But, as we shall see, this did not happen without great pain and emotional suffering. Jung's first reported memories, their sensory qualities, and their relationship to his early interpersonal experiences. This is part one. The first memory which Jung reports is from the age of 2 years. In the analytic literature, one's first memory is often accorded a large degree of psychological importance. Freud comments on Goethe's first childhood memory and talks about the meaning of the first memory in psychoanalysis. Freud states that in every psychoanalytic investigation of a life history, it usually happens that the very recollection to which the patient gives precedence, with which he introduces the story of his life, proves to be the most important, the very one that holds the key to the secret pages of his mind. With Freud's observation in mind, Jung describes his first memory as follows. I am lying in a pram in the shadow of a tree. It is a fine, warm summer day. The sky blue and the golden sunlight darting through green leaves. The hood of the pram has been left up. I have just awakened to the glorious beauty of the day and have a sense of indescribable well-being. I see the sun glittering through the leaves and blossoms of the bushes. Everything is wholly wonderful, colorful, and splendid. This is an ecstatic experience of the sensory world and the world of nature. What is conspicuously lacking is any mention of the interpersonal world. Often when conducting analysis with both adolescents and adults, the first memory that is reported involves the relationship with caregivers and parents. And in my own experience, this often happens that there can be very deep sensorial memories, but they're often of a skin sensory sort in terms of being held or sucking at the mother's breast or some sort of rocking. But this is really quite unusual, I have found, in working with adolescents and adults, this intense experience of nature. And it's so interesting because throughout Jung's work, this experience of nature has a very ecstatic feeling to it. His bond to nature was very, very deep, and I think incredibly important for him. And I think this is something very interesting to ponder and to reflect upon, why this is so, why this was so strong in him. Jung's early memories are largely devoid of people, and for the most part are descriptions of the sensory world and the realm of nature. And really this goes through his adolescent period. I was perplexed by the conspicuous absence of real people in Jung's descriptions of his infancy. What might this indicate about his early experience? I found one explanation for this in the work of Frances Tustin, who is a London-based child analyst. In her book, autistic states in children, Tustin notes that the lack of psychological connection between the child and the nurturing parents is the source of a traumatic sense of being disconnected from one's roots. It leads to an undue insistence on a constant physical presence and to the overvaluation of sensation-giving material objects. It is possible that Jung's turning to the sensory world around him was an important compensation for a lack of connection in the realm of interpersonal relationships. And this is something I can reflect on in a bit of a different way in terms of my work with over the years with psychotic and autistic children, is their incredible sensitivity to the sensorial world, the sense of color, the sense of sound, objects, minute changes in the office that might occur over time, these children are often aware of, but absolutely no recognition of me as a, in a sense, an interpersonal object, often for many, many months. So I find this very interesting. I'm talking about it from the clinical standpoint, and of course Jung is talking about his own memories from a very autobiographical standpoint. But I think often when we look at the extremes, such as in autistic and psychotic children, we can see certain deviations in development, which I think can tell us a great deal about the development of the human mind and of memory itself. And I hope we can go into this more, because it's a very interesting area, and I think very important in terms of the development of Jung's theories, in terms of his own feeling for nature and for the sensory world. Also, from my experience in infant observation, I have noted that when the infant has difficulty in reaching out towards the mother or caregiver, and where there has been some element of dysfunctionality in the mother-infant relationship, the infant will turn to the inanimate world as a way of trying to hold on to something that is stable and secure. And what I mean by this is that often when there's some dysfunctionality or some instability in the mother-infant relationship, what we tend to see is that while the mother is even diapering the baby or attempting to engage in some form of contact, bodily contact, the infant will also often gaze away or look at specific objects in the room as points of focus, rather than engaging the mother in a kind of en face, eye-to-eye contact, which I feel is very important in terms of the development of some sense of self, and to have that sense of self mirrored back through the mother's eyes. To see oneself in the eyes of the mother seems to be such a fundamental experience of early infancy, and one which clearly leads to the development of some sense of a cohesive self. But this is also this type of experience Jung does not describe with his mother early on. Coming back to this holding on to the inanimate world, it is a form of what's called a second skin, described by Esther Bick, who also was a London Kleinian analyst. The second skin, in a sense, is what the skin is. It's a holding function. It's something that the infant uses to hold themselves together. You see, this is why when there's an extreme deviation with autistic or psychotic children, they tend to hold on to objects in their hands often and will not let them go. They have to have something to hold on to, something that can help them define their own body image, because they're not feeling in some way that body image has been defined through the relationship with the mother early on. And it's through, I think, the early holding and the early bodily interchanges between mother and baby, or the mothering figure, whether it's the father, but certainly the mothering figure and the baby, that some early sense of body image begins to develop. And for particular reasons with psychotic and autistic children, when this more primal bonding has not taken place, there's an attempt to turn to the inanimate world to gain some sense of body boundary, of bodily self. And it seems that this sense of bodily self is really the beginning of later identity formation. I have observed infants who, during diapering changes, tend to focus almost exclusively on objects around them instead of on the mother and her gaze, as if the mother's gaze does not offer security or comfort. I wondered whether the infant Jung may have had a similar experience with his mother. Another early memory points to Jung's experience of the realm of sensation. I am sitting in our dining room on the west side of the house. And these memories, he's 83 years old, and he's remembering in exquisite detail, and aesthetic detail, memories from his earliest infancy. So I think that these were his deepest secrets that were so important for him in terms of his own, again, identity. Again, let me start. I am sitting in our dining room on the west side of the house, perched in a high chair and spooning up warm milk with bits of broken bread in it. The milk has a pleasant taste and a characteristic smell. This was the first time I became aware of the smell of milk. It was the moment when, so to speak, I became conscious of smelling. Now again, it's very interesting that the smelling process is not at all related to mother, or the smell of mother's milk, or the smell of mother's body, but it's related to an experience which, from a symbolic standpoint, I think we would consider quite, in a sense, maternal, in the dining room with the milk, with the bread, different sensations, different textures. There's a whole feeling to this. But when I imagine this in my own mind, what I see is a little baby alone playing with sensorial objects, playing with his food and exploring it. But again, in the absence of the other, and it's the conspicuous absence of other that made me ponder about the meaning of this. The sense of smell is often attached to some of our deepest memories. And I think this is so analytically that smells that come up in the office or otherwise tend to evoke enormous memories and a detachment. The smell of the analyst's body as the client passes by often has great meaning to that particular client in terms of the beginning of a deeper attachment and connection. I was reminded of Proust's entrancing description of the smell of tea and the moist taste of the petite madeleines, which triggered all the deep memories of his past, especially the yearning to be kissed by his mother before going to sleep at night and all that that meant to him. In a sense, Proust's whole novel is based on this primal experience of smell and his elaboration of that and the whole meaning of separation from his mother and the yearning for that deeper connection. His psychology, I think, was a completely different one from Jung's, but it's interesting that the pivotal memory is also around a sense of smell. And also, I think, in the novels of Virginia Woolf, this sensorial aspect is quite important and, again, linked to the early interpersonal relationships. So I think it comes up a great deal in art, and interesting meanings, I think, evolve from that, which we can go into. From the scientific standpoint, the studies of Aidan McFarlane in England point to the capacity of the infant to discriminate the smell of the mother's breast pad several days after birth. So the sense of smell is early on linked to interpersonal experience. And these were experiments, I'm not sure if you're familiar with them, but just very briefly, where the infant was on two sides of the infant's head. On one side were placed different pads. On one side of the infant's head were placed the pads from the mother's breast and the other side from someone who was not the mother. And he found that after just several days, the infant was quite able to discriminate the smell of mother and not mother and would turn much more towards the breast pad from the mother. So I think that says something about attachment and smell, that perhaps the sensorial, the smelling is perhaps as important or not more important early on than vision. Again, we see that Jung's memory is not in the realm of interpersonal experience, but rather the sensory realm. Often in the analysis of adults, early memories of being nursed at the mother's breast or being held and being fed by a bottle are prominent first memories involving smell and food. Here, Jung's first memory of smelling is related to an impersonal and solitary activity. The infant Jung is alone in a high chair spooning up milk. There are no personal reference. There is no image or sensory memory of the infant Jung being held or of an intimate relationship with the mother's breast. One would wonder, along the lines of Francis Tustin's theorizing, whether the emphasis on the sensory world suggests that there was some difficulty in the realm of interpersonal relating. Two other important memories are also described by Jung, which begin to shed light upon the emotional and psychological problems that he was experiencing at the time. Jung describes these memories as follows. A lovely summer evening, an aunt said to me, "Now I'm going to show you something." She took me out in front of the house on the road to Dashen. On the far horizon, the chain of the Alps lay bathed in glowing sunset reds. The Alps could be seen very clearly that evening. "Now look over there," I can hear her saying to me in a Swiss dialect. "The mountains are all red." For the first time, I consciously saw the Alps. Then I was told that the next day the village children would be going on a school outing to the Utleberg near Zurich. I wanted so much to go too. To my sorrow, I was informed that children, as small as I, could not go along. There was nothing to be done about it. From then on, the Utleberg in Zurich became an unattainable land of dreams, near to the glowing, snow-covered mountains. From Barbara Hannah's biography of Jung, as well as from Jung's autobiography, it is clear that the Alps had a great deal of psychological significance for him. In his adult years, Jung would often go for car rides in the Alps on Sundays. The Alps gave him a feeling of security and serenity. They offered to him a sense of soothing peacefulness, which was always attainable. Jung retreated to the realm of Mother Earth for solace and nourishment, not to the memory of his experience with the real flesh and blood mother, as is so eloquently described in Proust in his Remembrance of Things Past. The majestic beauty of the Alps offered him the peace and comfort he was constantly in search of. He found, I think, more comfort from being in contact with nature than he did with people. He was, in essence, a solitary man who was able to create a psychology of the interior space because of these early experiences. His depth psychology is less a psychology of interpersonal relationships and their vicissitudes over time than it is a psychology of the interior symbolic realm and internal development. I think this is because he had to turn away from the realm of interpersonal relating as an infant and had to rely upon his own self as a source of ongoing support. And I think also it's important to note that even the type of therapy that he evolved had some of this element in mind, because I think Jung was always very careful not to create, in a sense, too intense a transference situation. He didn't feel it was helpful for people, in his words, to become overly dependent upon the analyst. And I think this is why he often recommended that people not be seen too frequently and that they not be seen on the couch and that they, in a sense, be turned out on their own away from the analyst for periods of time so they could deal internally with their problems and to rely upon their dreams and other internal happenings, such as he promoted an active imagination. But there was always a very delicate aspect, I think, and in terms of my own period in Zurich, I found this so, where it was always very important not to become too dependent and to that the major trust should be placed upon one's dreams, one's internal life, as the source of one's own psychological truth. And this, I think, again, is related to these early experiences. Okay, part two, Jung's early experience with his mother. While Jung's early experiences had mainly an ecstatic emotional quality, this emotional tone may have been a defense against particularly painful affects. The source of this pain was apparently the significant problems within the Jung family. When Jung was 3 years old, his mother was hospitalized for what appears to have been a severe depression. She was away from him for several months, and Jung says that her hospitalization was related to difficulties that were surfacing in the parental relationship. During his mother's absence, he was taken care of by a maid. He also developed a severe skin rash, which he connected with the separation of his parents and his mother's hospitalization. excuse me. It is probable that his eczema was related to the sense of psychic catastrophe which Jung experienced on his separation from his mother. It was as if he were unable to contain torturous emotions within himself, and they burst out in a somatic form. Esther Bick's concept of a psychic skin is an important one in understanding this fundamental experience. According to Bick, in its most primitive form, the parts of the personality are felt to have no binding force amongst themselves and must therefore be held together in a way that is experienced by them passively, by the skin functioning as a boundary. So what this means is that the infant really doesn't have a symbolic capacity to integrate different affects, but they need to have some sensorial experience of integration. It's really only later, really during the third year of life, at least in my opinion, that some deeper symbolic capacity develops, and that some we can think about more coherently some form of separation. In the beginning years, I don't think we can really separate mother from infant. And really what's most important to think about in the first years of life is the actual environment, the interpersonal environment. So getting back to this, by this internal function of containing the parts of the self is dependent, but this internal function of containing the parts of the self is dependent initially on the introjection of an external object, experienced as capable of fulfilling this function. In other words, the mother needs to be experienced as containing, as holding. And later, the identification with this function of the object supersedes the unintegrated state and gives rise to the fantasy of internal and external spaces. In other words, it's this fundamental experience with the mother that becomes internalized, so there can develop in the child, as the child evolves, some good internal mother that can take care of the child. You see, the functions that the mother performs have to be internalized into the child over time. And this, of course, when we see clients, as we'll talk about tomorrow, with eating disorders, sexual identity conflicts, certainly they arise in adolescence quite frequently. There's often, I think always, this infantile core of a problem where the good internal mother has not been internalized, you know, hasn't developed. So there's not a sense of being able to mother oneself. And so what we find in adolescence often is a preponderance of self-destructive behavior, and usually always enacted against the body. And this is why we see all kinds of deviations and variations in terms of adolescent behavior, tattoos, eating disorders, alterations and mutilations of the body, etc., are quite frequent. And I think, at least in my own work with adolescents analytically, that this is always related to some deficiency, some deficit in how the functional aspects of the mother for holding and soothing and self-care have or have not been internalized. It appears that Jung was unable to identify with his mother's containing and soothing function. Jung's mother, Emily Preiswerk, was a homely woman and described by Jung as having two distinct personalities, one innocuous and human, the other uncanny. When the uncanny part emerged, it was often unexpected and frightening. Jung says, "She would then speak as if talking to herself, but what she said was aimed at me and usually struck to the core of my being so that I was stunned into silence." At times, his mother seemed dissociated, and Jung was deeply affected by these experiences. Because of this, he did not develop the kind of bond with his mother that would have led him to evolve the memory of being securely attached to a mothering figure. He had to turn to the sensory world for support, as he could hold on to the sensory world and nature in a more secure manner. He speaks of this period as follows: "I was deeply troubled by my mother's being away. From then on, I always felt mistrustful when the word love was spoken. The feeling I associated with woman was, for a long time, that of innate unreliability." While his mother was away in hospital, Jung was taken care of by a maid. Of this experience with the maid, he writes, "I still remember her picking me up and laying my head against her shoulder. She had black hair and an olive complexion and was quite different from my mother. I can see, even now, her hairline, her throat, with its darkly pigmented skin, and her ear. All this seemed to me very strange, and yet strangely familiar. It was as though she belonged not to my family, but only to me, as though she were connected in some way with other mysterious things I could not understand. This type of girl later became a component of my anima. The feeling of strangeness which she conveyed, and yet of having known her always, was a characteristic of that figure which later came to symbolize for me the whole essence of womanhood. The experience with the maid was an important one for Jung. It is the first time that a strong attachment to a mothering figure is described. It is the memory of a good connection with another individual, and she is elevated to a high level of importance in Jung's memories. It is possible that this experience led Jung to become interested in the dual mother motif. He elaborates on this motif in detail in Symbols of Transformation. In that work, Jung describes the hero as having two mothers. He is twice born. The dual mother motif suggests the idea of a dual birth. One of the mothers is the real human mother, the other is the symbolical mother. She is distinguished as being divine, supernatural, or in some way extraordinary. He who stems from two mothers is the hero. The first birth makes him a mortal man, the second an immortal half-god. The intense psychological and emotional connection to the maid and its consequences for Jung's development appears to be a corollary of this mythological motif. Jung relates the development of the anima concept to his experience with the maid who took care of him and not to his mother. From his description, it appears that the maid, not his mother, provided him with a secure attachment. The dual mother and two women theme was to play an important role throughout Jung's personal life. There were two women who were immensely important to Jung in his adult life. One was his wife Emma, mother of his five children. She came from a wealthy family, supported Jung early on in his career, and attempted in an eloquent manner to intervene in the conflict with Freud. Then there was the intellectual and spiritually ethereal Tony Wolff, who had once been Jung's patient and who helped Jung through the period of his confrontation with the unconscious after his break with Freud. The image that Jung paints of the maid is closely similar to the appearance of Tony Wolff, his, quote, Sora Mystica, or mystical sister, with whom Jung had a close, intimate, and perhaps even erotic sexual relationship through much of his adult life. Jung needed these two women in his life in order to maintain a sense of security and psychological equilibrium. Earlier in his career, his relationship with his patient Sabina Spielrein appears to have followed the same pattern, although in a less developed form. For Jung, this was a natural state of affairs, and in his letters to Freud, he attempts to justify this need by postulating that man has a natural tendency towards polygamy. It appears that Jung turned to Freud when he was having difficulty in his analyses of Sabina Spielrein and of his wife Emma. He told Freud that he had uncovered a strong resistance in Emma during the course of her analysis, and that this resistance was related to Emma's being unable to accept his underlying polygamous nature. which of course is it's hard to comment on this. I think we always I'm not trying really to pass any judgment. I mean, this we have to understand is really the origins of analysis, and I don't think obviously that they have the experience that we have today, but you can imagine, I think, emotionally how he must have felt, both analyzing Sabina Spielrein and his wife, and he was having what appears to have been an affair with Sabina, and she also tried to confer with Freud. And this was all elaborated in the book The Secret Symmetry. I'm not sure how many people are familiar with that. We can go into it later, if you wish. But anyway, he felt, Jung, that this was appropriate, and he felt that he had his own explanation that it had to do with his own this underlying polygamist aspect, which he felt was, in a sense, archetypal in man, which I think goes against certain research and psychological theories which we have today, which indicates that certainly babies have what's called a monotrophic attachment, usually, which is that the baby tends to want to become attached to one person, and certainly this follows throughout the life cycle, this need for one major attachment. But I think because Jung's own infancy was distorted in this particular way, in terms of the intervention of the maid and his deep feeling for her, as well as the mother abandoning him, that, and as I'll get into, he couldn't really trust one woman. And this explains some of the deviations in terms of his sexuality and relationship later in life, which he felt quite, in a sense, was more the way things needed to be in terms of Tony Wolf being with his family on weekends and her being quite integrated, yet he was still carrying on a relationship with her. And I think Emma's distress was always quite noted in the family. Anyway, let's go into this a bit more here. In a letter to Freud, dated 7 March 1909, Jung describes this complicated state of affairs as follows. "A complex is playing old Harry with me," Jung says. "A woman patient whom years ago I pulled out of a very sticky neuroses with unstinting effort," and I believe this refers to Sabina Spielrein, "has violated my confidence and my friendship in the most mortifying way imaginable. She has kicked up a vile scandal solely because I denied myself the pleasure of giving her a child." Now, this was one of the main, in the diaries that were published, one of the main themes that brought about the breakup of Sabina and Jung, and why he terminated her analysis quite precipitously, is that she became very fixated on producing his child. And of course, this is often a theme that comes up in terms of the analytical baby that is produced between analyst and analysand. But here it was very concretized, and we don't know how much of an actual affair they were having at the time and how much, in a sense, the symbolic container might have been interfered with. But he terminated the analysis after she became quite demanding in this way. And he says, "I have always acted the gentleman towards her, but before the bar of my rather too sensitive conscience, I nevertheless don't feel clean. And that is what hurts the most, because my intentions were always honorable. But you know how it is. The devil can use even the best of things for the fabrication of filth. Meanwhile, I have learnt an unspeakable amount of marital wisdom. For until now, I had a totally inadequate idea of my polygamous components, despite all self-analysis. Now I know where and how the devil can be laid by the heels. These painful, yet extremely salutary insights have churned me up hellishly inside. But for that very reason, I hope, have secured me..." Jung writes, "During the time when I didn't write to you, I was plagued by complexes, and I detest wailing letters. This time, it was not I who was duped by the devil, but my wife," apparently referring to the relationship with Sabina Spielrein, "who lent an ear to the evil spirit and staged a number of jealous scenes groundlessly. At first, my objectivity got out of joint. but afterwards snapped back again, whereupon my wife also strengthened herself out brilliantly. And then he goes on to say, analysis of one's spouse is one of the more difficult things. Unless mutual freedom is assured. Furthermore, he says, the prerequisite for a good marriage, it seems to me, is the license to be unfaithful. No comment. He could not put all of his trust into Emma, who treated him in many ways as a mother would do, because he feared abandonment. And he needed Tony Wolfe as much as he needed the maid of his infancy, someone whom he could rely upon when emotional difficulties arose. And I think as we read about his life, there was often this back and forth movement between Emma and Tony Wolfe, and that she served actually a stabilizing force for him. And it was with her, I think, that his, in a sense, number two personality had a real place. He, like his mother, also had two personalities, he felt, the number one personality and the number two personality. And the number two personality was much more related to his true self, his deeper self, the unconscious. And this is what, apparently, he was able to express so deeply with Tony Wolfe. Another result of Jung's separation from his mother was what appears to be a childhood depression resulting in self-destructive fantasies and behavior. He reports having a serious accident while crossing the bridge over the Rhine Falls at the time of his mother's hospitalization. He noted that the maid caught me just in time. I already had one leg under the railing and was about to slip through. These things point to an unconscious suicidal urge, or it may be, to a fatal resistance to life in this world. There were other accidents, a fall downstairs and a fall against the stove leg. His accident proneness points to a feeling of being uncontained in the mother-child relationship and to a sense of rage which was directed against the self and not against the abandoning mother. Often children who are accident-prone have experienced difficulties in the mother-child relationship and do not feel safely held within the mother's attention. Jung's preoccupation with dead corpses, drowned bodies, and funerals in his early childhood also supports the hypothesis of a childhood depression based on a dysfunctional mother-child relationship. Part 3, The Dream of the Underground Phallus. Jung reports that his earliest remembered dream occurred when he was between the ages of 3 and 4. It is a cognitively complex and highly structured dream, and thus not probable that he had the dream at that time, but probably a bit later in childhood. The dream of the underground phallus is a critically important one for Jung's development. It is a symbolic rendering of the birth of his creative genius, and is, I think, the experiential foundation of analytical psychology. He could not put all of his trust into Emma, who treated him in many ways as a mother would do, because he feared abandonment, and he needed Tony Wolfe as much as he needed the maid of his infancy, someone whom he could rely upon when emotional difficulties arose. And I think as we read about his life, there was often this back and forth movement between Emma and Tony Wolfe, and that she served actually a stabilizing force for him. And it was with her, I think, that his, in a sense, number two personality had a real place. He, like his mother, also had two personalities, he felt, the number one personality and the number two personality. And the number two personality was much more related to his true self, his deeper self, the unconscious. And this is what, apparently, he was able to express so deeply with Tony Wolfe. Another result of Jung's separation from his mother was what appears to be a childhood depression resulting in self-destructive fantasies and behavior. He reports having a serious accident while crossing the bridge over the Rhine Falls at the time of his mother's hospitalization. He noted that the maid caught me just in time. I already had one leg under the railing and was about to slip through. These things point to an unconscious suicidal urge, or it may be, to a fatal resistance to life in this world. There were other accidents, a fall downstairs and a fall against the stove leg. His accident proneness points to a feeling of being uncontained in the mother-child relationship and to a sense of rage which was directed against the self and not against the abandoning mother. Often children who are accident prone have experienced difficulties in the mother-child relationship and do not feel safely held within the mother's attention. Jung's preoccupation with dead corpses, drowned bodies, and funerals in his early childhood also supports the hypothesis of a childhood depression based on a dysfunctional mother-child relationship. Part 3, The Dream of the Underground Phallus. Jung reports that his earliest remembered dream occurred when he was between the ages of 3 and 4. It is a cognitively complex and highly structured dream, and thus not probable that he had the dream at that time, but probably a bit later in childhood. The dream of the underground phallus is a critically important one for Jung's development. It is a symbolic rendering of the birth of his creative genius and is, I think, the experiential foundation of analytical psychology. Before reflecting upon the dream, I would like to present it as it is reported by Jung. And this is the dream. The vicarage stood quite alone near Laufen Castle, and there was a big meadow stretching back from the sexton's farm. In the dream, I was in this meadow. Suddenly, I discovered a dark, rectangular, stone-lined hole in the ground. I had never seen it before. I ran forward curiously and peered down into it. Then I saw a stone stairway leading down. Hesitantly and fearfully, I descended. At the bottom was a doorway with a round arch, closed off by a green curtain. It was a big, heavy curtain of worked stuff like brocade, and it looked very sumptuous. Curious to see what might be hidden behind, I pushed it aside. I saw before me in the dim light a rectangular chamber about 30 feet long. The ceiling was arched and of hewn stone. The floor was laid with flagstones, and in the center a red carpet ran from the entrance to a low platform. On this platform stood a wonderfully rich golden throne. I'm not certain, but perhaps a red cushion lay on the seat. It was a magnificent throne, a real king's throne in a fairy tale. Something was standing on it, which I thought at first was a tree trunk, 12 to 15 feet high and about 1.5 to 2 feet thick. It was a huge thing, reaching almost to the ceiling, but it was of a curious composition. It was made of skin and naked flesh, and on top there was something like a rounded head with no face and no hair. On the very top of the head was a single eye gazing motionlessly upward. It was fairly light in the room, although there were no windows and no apparent source of light. Above the head, however, was an aura of brightness. The thing did not move. Yet, I had the feeling that it might at any moment crawl off the throne like a worm and creep towards me. I was paralyzed with terror. At that moment, I heard from outside and above me my mother's voice. She called out, quote, "Yes, just look at him. That is the man-eater." That intensified my terror still more, and I awoke sweating and scared to death. For many nights afterwards, I was afraid to go to sleep because I feared I might have another dream like that. Jung did not share this dream with anyone until he was 65 years old. And it remained for him one of the most important internal experiences of his life. The dream's intense vividness and sensory quality, as well as the emotional terror it evokes, is impressive. Jung amplified and associated later in life to the dream and felt that it was a representation of a descent into the earth and an archetypal initiation into the secrets of life. Jung saw it as an initiation into the secrets of the earth and the realm of darkness. Jung reports that his intellectual life had an unconscious beginning at that time. From a developmental perspective, I think this dream also conveys Jung's dread of the penis, of his own phallic excitement, as well as his terror of the mother's penis inside, the terror of the penis inside the mother's body. According to Melanie Klein, the mother's body contains all that is desirable, including the father's penis. When his mother says in the dream, "Beware of the man-eater," she is voicing Jung's concern about potential castration by his combined bad and dangerous internal parents. The dream conveys some of Jung's anxiety about what is going on inside of mother's body. His fear of potential castration by the father's penis inside the mother could have made it difficult for him to relate in a productive way to his own childhood sexuality. And this may provide an explanation for his early renunciation of Freud's theory of childhood sexuality. Jung attempted to refute Freud's theory of childhood sexuality by stating that the nutritive function had a greater importance in children than did sexuality. In clinical work with children, I have found that bodily experiences, which include sexual sensations and fantasies, are very important and need to be integrated into the analytic treatment if deeper progress is to be made. In his writings, Jung tended to minimize the importance of sexuality in early childhood, and this is a deficit in his theory which has needed to be corrected. In addition, the external situation which Jung found himself in has a great deal to do with the content of the dream. At the time, he was sleeping in the same room with his father, while his mother was in a separate bedroom. And apparently this went on for a number of years. So the parents apparently were not sleeping in the same bedroom, and then Jung again was with his father. He was fearful, Jung, of his mother's presence as she was connected with strange occurrences, he states. From the door of my mother's room came frightening influences. At night, mother was strange and mysterious. One night I saw coming from her door a faintly luminous, indefinite figure whose head detached itself from the neck and floated along in front of it in the air like a little moon. Immediately another head was produced and again detached itself. I had anxiety dreams of things that were now small, now large. So this enormous hallucinatory quality emanating from the mother and this sort of terror and scary quality is quite prominent. For instance, I saw a tiny ball at a great distance. Gradually it approached, growing steadily into a monstrous and suffocating object. Or I saw telegraph wires with birds sitting on them, and the wires grew thicker and thicker, and my fear greater until the terror awoke me. At the time, I was sick with pseudo-croup, accompanied by choking fits, which can be quite serious. I mean, I don't know if you have been with a child who's had croup, and the sense of not being able to breathe and suffocating is quite terrifying. One night during an attack, I stood at the foot of the bed, my head bent back over the bed rail, while my father held me under the arms. Above me, I saw a glowing blue circle about the size of a full moon, and inside it moved golden figures which I thought were angels. The vision was repeated, and each time it allayed my fear of suffocation. But the suffocation returned in the anxiety dreams. I see in this a psychogenic factor. The atmosphere of the house was beginning to be unbreathable. From this situation, we can surmise that the parents had a dysfunctional sexual relationship and that his mother was imbued with fear and dread. External evidence of the parents' sexual difficulties was that only one other child was born, a sister, 9 years after Jung's birth. Now, this is before the period of contraception, so it's quite unusual in Switzerland. Furthermore, in Swiss families at that time, it was unusual in Swiss families at that time, especially since both Jung's father and mother came from families with 8 children each. So they each came from quite large families. The development of childhood sexuality is connected with the idea the child has of the parent's sexuality. And children are more secure when they feel their parents are united in a loving, sexual way. Jung's concept of sexuality was certainly influenced by this external situation. In Jung's dream, his mother calls the phallus the man-eater, potentially the castrator. This might be interpreted by the child Jung to mean that the father's penis was experienced as dangerous to the mother. And of course, certainly perhaps dangerous to Jung if there was any type of molestation which might have occurred between father and Jung since they were sleeping together, although he doesn't mention this. Although he does mention molestation by other older men, by another older man who was a close friend of the father's later. Since their relationship was so difficult, another father and mother, evidently estranged, the child Jung would have an arduous task in developing and integrating his own sense of sexual identity. From the archetypal standpoint, the phallus in the dream is an enormously creative symbol. For the ancient Romans, the phallus symbolized a man's sacred genius, the source of his physical and mental creative powers. The phallus symbolically is the dispenser of all his inspired or brilliant ideas and of his buoyant joy in life. In classical Greece, the entire Dionysiac religion, and with it both tragedy and comedy, seems to have sprung out of a systematic veneration of the phallus and the male generative function. The enthroned phallus with the eye on top could signify the depth of consciousness Jung was to attain in his lifetime. Jung encountered both the terror and awe of the phallus, penis, during his childhood. For Jung, the anxiety as well as the awe and mystery of the enormous internal phallus penis provided him with an experience which facilitated the unfolding of his creative potential and led him to develop the feeling that important and profound things were happening inside of his mind. The enormous phallus in the dream represented this fertile potential within Jung. Part 4. The construction of the mannequin and the development of Jung's concepts of self and individuation. Jung was a lonely child. His childhood memories were mostly of solitary play. He would spend hours constructing buildings and towers out of blocks, which he would then destroy. He would draw endless scenes of battles and bombardments, all reflecting his own inner turmoil. And it's interesting also that during his period of confrontation with the unconscious, he talks again about this solitary play with blocks by the Lake of Zurich, which provided him with so much self-soothing at the time, but it was always in this solitary way. A close childhood friend, Albert Oeri, who was really a very long-time friend of Jung's, describes Jung as being hard to approach, somewhat detached, and usually preferring to play alone. On one occasion, he says, Carl sat in the middle of a room, occupied himself with a little bowling game, and didn't pay the slightest attention to me. I had never come across such an asocial monster before. This is his best friend. During the 10th year, he engaged in an important activity, which was to have significance for the rest of his life. He describes this activity as follows. My disunion with myself and uncertainty in the world at large led me to an action which at the time was quite incomprehensible to me. I had in those days a yellow, varnished pencil case of the kind commonly used by primary school pupils with a little lock and the customary ruler. At the end of this ruler, I now carved a little mannequin about 2 inches long with frock coat, top hat, and shiny black boots. I colored him black with ink, sawed him off the ruler, and put him in the pencil case, where I made him a little bed. I even made a coat for him out of a bit of wool. In the case, I also placed a smooth, oblong, blackish stone from the Rhine, which I had painted with watercolors to look as though it were divided into an upper and lower half, and had long carried around in my trouser pocket. This was his stone. All this was a great secret. Secretly, I took the case to the forbidden attic at the top of the house, forbidden because the floorboards were worm-eaten and rotten, and hid it with great satisfaction on one of the beams under the roof, for no one must ever see it. I knew that not a soul would ever find it there. No one could discover my secret and destroy it. I felt safe, and the tormenting sense of being at odds with myself was gone. In all difficult situations, whenever I had done something wrong, or my feelings had been hurt, or when my father's irritability or my mother's invalidism oppressed me, I thought of my carefully bedded down and wrapped up mannequin and his smooth, prettily covered stone. From time to time, often at intervals of weeks, I secretly stole up to the attic when I could be certain that no one would see me. Then I clambered up on the beam, opened the case, and looked at my mannequin and his stone. Each time I did this, I placed in the case a little scroll of paper on which I had previously written something during school hours in a secret language of my own invention. The addition of a new scroll always had the character of a solemn ceremonial act. Unfortunately, I cannot remember what I wanted to communicate to the mannequin. I only know that my letters constituted a kind of library for him. I fancy, though, I cannot be certain, that they may have consisted of sayings that particularly pleased me. With the mannequin, Jung could experience his real self. I think it is significant that this secret image is a masculine one, which links the experience to the development of his self-image and also connects with the phallus of his earliest dream memory. The image of the mannequin also relates to the Jesuits Jung describes seeing in black coats, top hats, and boots, who presided at the funerals he witnessed with extreme curiosity. This identification with the mannequin infused him with a secret power, counteracting the powerlessness associated with his father. By placing the mannequin inside the pencil case, the child Jung created a safe symbolic container for his evolving self. Again, Jung turned to his own internal resources in an enormously creative way as a source of comfort, soothing, and support. The interpersonal milieu was unable to provide him with what he needed at the time, and he was able, through his own efforts, to construct an inanimate object that was secret and his own and to which he could go to for security and comfort. At the time, he felt that the safety of his life depended upon the mannequin. In this little wooden figure, Jung gave shape to his own internal strivings in a concrete way. Jung's notion of the self as something secret and inviolable, the philosopher's stone of alchemy, which was a symbol of the self and preoccupied him in his later years, all have their origins in this experience with the mannequin. Through the use of the mannequin, Jung was able to give shape to his self in a symbolic way. The need to support a secret part of himself, which he did not share with others, and which he needed to maintain a sense of separateness, was expressed through his construction of the mannequin. Jung's mother was viewed as being intrusive. She was unable to support the development of his self in a viable manner. She disrupted his self-development. Jung needed a more intact sense of boundary between himself and his mother. This is why he needed the secret mannequin. The development of his true self took place through his connection to his own interior self. The stone stood for the self, symbolically placed in the pencil case in the attic. It was a symbol of his own psyche. It provided an important experience for the development of his concept of the self, as the mannequin possessed a numinosity and conveyed a sense of necessity, which gave it an important functional meaning as a psychic integrator. Now let me deal with one last experience before we stop. The waking fantasy of God defecating on Basel Cathedral and the origins of active imagination. When Jung was 12 years old and attending school in Basel, he developed a severe school phobia. The onset of the phobia coincided with a series of fainting spells he had whenever he had to return to school, or whenever he was asked by his parents to do his homework. For more than 6 months, he did not attend school and stayed at home with his mother. He engaged in long periods of solitary play. His parents feared he had a form of epilepsy. Our current understanding of school phobias leads us to believe that they have a psychogenic cause and are often related to a disturbed relationship with the mother. In school phobias, problems with separation are often experienced by both mother and child. In the clinical literature, the late onset of a school phobia indicates that an emotional conflict has existed for some time in an often insidious and unrecognized manner. The child's relationship to an emotionally disturbed parent is thought to be at the core of the symptom. After about 6 months at home, and through an act of sheer will and endurance, Jung forced himself back to school. It appears that a potentially severe blow to his fragile self-image prompted his psychological change. He overheard his father talking to a friend about his concern that the young Jung had an incurable case of epilepsy and might never be able to work and support himself. This remark aroused such intense anxiety in Jung that he felt determined to prove his father wrong. Through enormous effort, he was able to get back to school. Jung writes that from this experience, he learned the meaning of a neurosis. But I do not think that Jung was able to resolve his psychological conflicts through his act of will. Rather, his pronounced aggressivity, which was linked in fantasy to his experience of his anality, persisted. These affects found expression in his waking fantasy of God defecating on Basel Cathedral. The waking fantasy occurred that same year when he was 12 and began when he was standing in the cathedral square in Basel. I think that this experience also provided the experiential foundation for Jung's concept of active imagination. Active imagination is a therapeutic technique Jung evolved, whereby a symbolic image is concentrated upon so that fantasy images and affects can be elaborated and reflected upon. It is a type of waking dream taking place in a state of reverie. Jung describes his experience at Basel Cathedral as follows. One fine summer day, I came out of school at noon and went to the cathedral square. The sky was gloriously blue, the day one of radiant sunshine. The roof of the cathedral glittered, the sun sparkling from the new brightly glazed tiles. I was overwhelmed by the beauty of the sight and thought, the world is beautiful, and the church is beautiful, and God made all this and sits above it far away in the blue sky on a golden throne. And at this point, Jung was unable to go on with his thoughts. For several days, Jung was unable to think what he thought would be a terrible idea. He attempted to try to hold himself together by not thinking the thought. He says, again and again, the forbidden thought tried to break out, and I struggled desperately to fend it off. I gathered all my courage, as though I were about to leap forthwith into hellfire and let the thought come. I saw before me the cathedral, the blue sky. God sits on his golden throne, high above the world, and from under the throne, an enormous turd falls upon the sparkling new roof, shatters it, and breaks the walls of the cathedral asunder. I felt an enormous and indescribable relief. Instead of the expected damnation, grace had come upon me, and with it an unutterable bliss such as I had never known. I wept for happiness and gratitude. It was as though I had experienced an illumination. That was what my father had not understood, I thought. He had failed to experience the will of God, had opposed it for the best reasons and out of the deepest faith, and that was why he never experienced the miracle of grace, which heals all and makes all comprehensible. Jung's aggression towards both of his emotionally unresponsive parents was expressed in this fantasy. Jung's father, a clergyman filled with self-doubt about his calling, did not provide Jung with an adequate model for identification. Jung felt that his father had never known the inner, living experience of God. Therefore, his faith and belief were empty. Jung says he always had to experience and know. He could not just believe. which is what his father wanted him to do, although he felt his father really doubted. In the fantasy of God defecating on Basel Cathedral, Jung symbolically experienced the destruction of the father's world, and for Jung, the patriarchal culture as well. His mother, represented in the fantasy as Mother Church, was often unavailable, difficult to reach, and often emotionally detached. Jung's anger at the threshold of puberty was enormous and largely unresolved. Both parents had seriously betrayed him, and he had to turn within himself for support. Although this had a precocious quality and left him vulnerable throughout his life to deep psychological distress. When Jung felt let down, abandoned, or betrayed, he would fall into dark states of mind and experience states of fragmentation and disorganization. His experience with Freud is a case in point. Toward Freud, he initially felt a veneration, which for Jung took the form of, in his words, a religious crush. He felt deeply for Freud, but was conflicted by these feelings because he says, quote, as a boy, I had been the victim of a sexual assault by a man I had once worshipped. When his relationship with Freud collapsed, he tumbled deeply into the realm of the unconscious and was able again, through his enormous will and creativity, to give shape to his disintegrated psychic states. This was the period during which his critically important self-analysis took place. And in conclusion, creating his psychological theories was a reparative process for Jung. He could not, I think, develop a coherent theory of child development because his own childhood had been so terribly painful, and he did not have the possibility of working through his infantile traumas in a contained analysis as we would think of it today. Rather, Jung delved within himself to find his own healing potential. What he has left us is a remarkable legacy of a creative encounter with the depths of the human spirit. His work has shown how the inner world can compensate for a painful and tormented outer experience in a creative and transformative way. What Jung's legacy makes us realize is how important it is to integrate both the internal and external world in analysis, and how difficult this process can be. I think that Jung's experiences in infancy and childhood underline the importance that early experiences have for the shaping of psychological experiences. In addition, they point the way towards further developments in our science and practice. For analytical psychology, the tasks remain to integrate the realms of the infant, the child, and the interpersonal world into our already developed symbolic approach. In this way, a deeper integration of personality will be possible. In this way, we both honor Jung's legacy and extend theory and practice to areas he was unable to fully explore. This is the end. Thank you. Our first experience of the world is through our sensations. So this is, I think, the typology that Jung developed is more of what I would consider a kind of ego psychology. That, in other words, it differs. We get to know our deeper functions a bit later in childhood, you know, because they develop the capacity to think and to symbolize is not yet there. Thinking in terms of the child psychology, is Piaget and others talk about, is very much thinking through the senses, the sensory motor period, as it's called. So this is quite important. And what I was trying to emphasize in terms of Jung's early infancy was how emphasized this sensorial aspect was. More on things than people, using sensations and nature as a form of holding. And again, throughout his life and memory, dreams, and reflections, as Gordon was saying here, this aspect, I would agree, was always critically important for him. His experience of the natural world and being in nature was always quite critical. And he talks about that more than he would talk about people, really. And another thing I was talking with Gordon here about was that in terms of even his sister, he had one sister. She's mentioned two times in Memories, Dreams, Reflections, once when she was born and once when she died. And what happened in between is very hard to know. But I mean, and his sister had a very different faith than Jung. She never married. She always lived at home with mother, and she died fairly young. But here we would think a very significant relationship and absolutely no discussion of it. So again, I think this is other evidence for this. Yes.
What was Jung's relationship with father that he is a mother.
Yes.
Are there any lessons from this?
There are, well, all I have heard about that, and I've tried to inquire, and it is more anecdotal. And that, again, it's hard to say. I mean, certainly he was very involved with his professional life. He was doing a great deal of writing. He was in his tower. So I don't know, really. And the children, I hesitate to state what I've heard secondhand without being reliable. But I think it's also interesting how little he talks about the children in Memories, Dreams, Reflections. In fact, he doesn't talk about them. And I think from what I've read is that Emma was sort of the mother who took care of the kids in a wonderfully warm way. But we have very little information about how he was in terms of the time spent with the children or his reactions to the children and their different developments. None of them became an analyst, as far as I know. One of his daughters, I know, was an astrologer, and one of his sons an architect. I don't know enough about the others. But it's interesting that none of them followed in his footsteps in terms of their identification with him. Do you know perhaps something about...
I was asking from the authority of the
name, yes.
Why did he not develop a theory of self-development?
Yes.
And he was saying that he didn't pay attention to the development.
I don't know. I don't want to say that. That's a rather strong statement. But I think that clearly he did write this one article, as I've said, The Psychic Complex of a Child, which was about one of his children. So clearly he was watching her quite closely. And this is he talks about the theory of reincarnation being archetypal, based on some of her early fantasies. So clearly he was involved with that. But otherwise, there's very little. That's the only thing that he's written about in terms of his own children. And that doesn't come up very much even in his letters to Freud. Freud talks a great deal about his children, but Jung talks very little about his children in the letters. And that was a period when they were all sort of being, starting to be born, so I don't know.
Yes.
Does he write to them?
Doesn't he write some of his letters to them? Remember what letter to
them? I'm sure, yes, I hope, yes. Do you remember what the letter might have indicated or the feeling? Yeah.
Writing a kind of fatherly
letter.
Yeah. This is what is happening. But it seems to be some interest.
Yes. Yes. No, I'm sure he did. I'm not trying to paint a black or white picture at all in any way. Yes, well, over here. Sorry.
Well, the thing that the son, he was
Franz. Yes, that's what I've heard secondhand, but I don't know. Yes, sir, in the back. Yes. Yes, sir. Well, I think they were hallucinations of some sort. I think he was in a feverish state, I believe, when he had croup. So that perhaps could be some explanation for that. But his mother was always associated with, I think, what he would call the uncanny. You know, for instance, he places a great deal of emphasis on that experience when his mother, actually there's another time when he talks about his mother and sister being at home, and there was the explosion in the cabinet, and the knife was split into three pieces. Somehow that was also very much associated with her. So there was always this, it's not that, and it was not always bizarre, it was sometimes he felt very helpful. For instance, when he was reading a lot of philosophy, Hegel, Schopenhauer, and he was not feeling a resonance with that, his mother said, well, you should read Goethe, just sort of out of the blue. And that, again, became one of the fundamental experiences in his life. So for him, she also, later in life, in his adolescence, I think, had a very positive impact, this sort of uncanny aspect of her. And that experience with the knife gave him some confirmation of parapsychological phenomena. So certainly the interest was very much there, and I think the interest came very much from mother in that type of phenomenology and phenomena. The father doesn't seem to have played a role in that. His theological beliefs were quite rigid, apparently, and he was in the midst of a deep crisis when Jung was getting into adolescence around his religious beliefs. And his father always told him, even when he was trying to choose a career, he says, whatever you do, you can do anything, but please don't be a theologian. Neglected? No, I don't think so. I don't think he was so much neglected as perhaps misunderstood or not understood adequately. I mean, he was a child with, as we can see, enormously complex things happening inside of him. But I don't think he felt he could communicate them to anybody. You know, he felt his mother lied to him at times about his father. And he was deeply disappointed in that. And he says from that experience onward, he could never trust his mother with anything deeply personal. So it's not that they weren't there and available to him. It's his own relationship to them was somewhat tormented. And again, with his father was very much there, and they shared the room for many years. And he wasn't, in fact, it seems like there was a sort of too much connection. But again, of what sort, where he wasn't perhaps allowed to have his own needed separation, in that sense, his own secure space, so he had to find this secret place in the attic. So one gets the feeling that the boundaries were not quite clear between the different family members. Yes, Trun. Well, certainly one aspect that I mentioned was that I think it represents the mother's unconscious relationship to the penis. How conscious it was, I don't know, but certainly her own relationship to the father's penis and their sexuality was certainly indicated by the dream, by saying that's the man-eater. So it has some kind of ominous connotation. It doesn't have the sort of creative, generative feeling. Sorry, did you have something else?
Oh, I was going to...
Yes. He never describes anything, I believe, where there's an intimate relationship between father and mother that I can recall. Yes. Absolutely. Yes. Yes. I absolutely agree with you. I had stated in my interpretation that it was his relationship to the internal parents. How he was trying to construct them inside of himself was very difficult. And I think he was, as you said, I completely agree, caught between them in a certain way. And he couldn't bring them together. You know, I think for the child, and I see this in doing child analysis, to bring the parents together, as I stated, in a kind of healthy, loving intercourse is often a sign of great improvement. You know, when we can have, as adults, these images inside of ourselves of the masculine and feminine aspects being related in an intimate sexual way, this is also very important for our own sexuality. But I think for Jung, this was very difficult. He was struggling with this quite a great deal. And I didn't get in so much to his relationship with his father yet, but I think it becomes very critical in adolescence, where the relationship with his father is much discussed with a great deal of pain in terms of the evolution of his own masculine identity. how much he had to turn away from the father. And I think the other aspect was this man he venerated who sexually abused him, he said. But again, he was 18 years old, apparently, when this happened. And at least my experience with 18-year-olds is that they know a great deal about sexuality. And it's not that they're so-called just sexually abused. There's some consensual aspect to sexuality at that age, usually, unless the person is forced in a rape situation. And this was not the situation that occurred. And I think this also brought up conflicts with Freud, his search for some idealized father who he could admire, you know, to help him counteract this image of this helpless, his own father, who he perceived as quite helpless and quite doubt-ridden, and somebody who he could not identify with. So it's a very complicated, the issue of the father is extremely complex in his development. Yes? Justifying it. Developing. Sorry. Please, could you elaborate on that? But his father... He,